This is Audible.
Harper Audio presents Just the Funny Parts and a Few Hard Truths About Sneaking into the Hollywood Boys Club by Nell Scovell. Read by Amy Hone. Forward by Sheryl Sandberg. For decades, archaeologists assumed that prehistoric cave paintings were the work of male hunters who wanted to capture their dramatic feats. But a recent study revealed a hidden truth. One researcher looked at the artist's signatures, handprints stenciled on the walls, and compared the relative lengths of fingers to those of modern humans. The data showed that 75% of the early cave painters were women. This revelation is important for our understanding of prehistoric human culture. It also means that the last time women held most of the jobs in the entertainment field was about 20,000 years ago. The entertainment industry is notoriously tough on women. Then again, so is every industry. The challenges Nell has faced during her TV career will seem familiar to many women and be eye-opening for many men. Nell overcame those obstacles in the ways most women do, by working hard, taking risks, making her career a jungle gym instead of a ladder, and having a partner who was a true partner. Nell didn't just help me write Lean In. She lived it. Whoever said feminists weren't funny never met Nell. Her sly sense of humor is one of the main reasons why I've asked her to collaborate again and again. Comedy makes the good times and the bad times better. While working on Lean In, Nell and I found ways to laugh in the face of gender bias. And while working on Option B, as hard as it was, we found ways to laugh in the face of death. One of the most irreverent stories in Option B involves Nell at her beloved mother's funeral. Nell has four siblings, and she opened her eulogy by holding up an envelope and declaring, "I have in this envelope the name of Mom's favorite child." Humor is a release. It breaks the tension in stressful situations. And as Just the Funny Parts shows, Nell has been in a lot of stressful situations. She knows the pressure of being the lowliest writer on a TV staff, as well as the pressure of being a showrunner. I love that she is passing along the inside knowledge she gained during three decades in the trenches. Nell's voice is filled with honesty and wisdom, even when it occasionally shakes with rage. Humor can also give us hope when there is no hope, which is why women have always been funny. They just haven't always received credit for it. As Nell maintains, if Larry David were living in 18th century France and heard the peasants had no bread, his response, "Let them eat cake," would have made people laugh. But when Marie Antoinette said it, they chopped off her head. Like the cave painters working in the shadows, women have long toiled behind the scenes in Hollywood. That's why it's important that writer-directors like Nell speak up. Her story is inspiring. Not because she was unstoppable, but because when she did get stopped, she found ways to keep writing, continue being creative, and always, but always, maintain her sense of humor. I've seen firsthand Nell's commitment to support and advocate for other women. She once told me about a talented young TV writer who reached out to vent after a soul-crushing meeting. The woman said she couldn't take the rudeness and rejection any longer. She was tired of competing for the one female slot on comedy shows. Nell gave her a pep talk, sharing tips on how to deal with the frustration. A week later, the young writer emailed her, excited. "You have been such an inspiration for me to follow my writing dreams," she wrote, "that I wanted you to be one of the first to know that I just got my very first staff writing job." The young woman mentioned the name of the project, which Nell recognized because she'd been up for the one female slot herself. Nell laughed as she relayed the story. She was truly happy for her colleague. Both Nell and I look forward to the day when there are no female writers, just writers. We share an unshakable belief that having an equal number of men and women sitting at the table where decisions are made will make this world fairer and better. It will also make the world funnier. Introduction. That which doesn't kill me allows me to regroup and retaliate. My personal motto. In 1991, a friend told me a joke that made me both laugh and shudder. We were strolling through the Universal Studios lot where I worked on the sitcom Coach and felt awed by my surroundings. Our writers' offices were located in Lucille Ball's old dressing room. On the way to the commissary, I passed Alfred Hitchcock's bungalow. After lunch, I might sneak onto Soundstage 12 and visit the visitor center of the original Jurassic Park. That day, my friend and I were heading to the backlot to check out the clock tower from Back to the Future. I was feeling excited about my own future. Although my first 5 TV jobs had ended abruptly, my career had finally taken off. I even had an upcoming meeting with a feature film producer who wanted to hear my fresh ideas. My friend, who had more experience in the industry, listened to me gush and then jumped in. You do know the joke about the 4 stages of every writer's career, right? I shook my head. He launched into an old show business joke, using my name to illustrate. What are the 4 stages of every Hollywood writer's career? Stage 1. Who is Nell Scovell? Stage 2. Get me Nell Scovell. Stage 3. Get me a younger, cheaper Nell Scovell. Stage 4. Who is Nell Scovell? The joke was like a DeLorean time machine, and I instantly glimpsed the unfolding of my entire career. Just 3 years earlier, I'd been an unknown. Now I was hovering between Stage 1 and Stage 2. My rise probably meant an experienced writer was getting pushed out, and someday that experienced writer getting pushed out would be me. My fresh take would become stale, and I'd return to obscurity. The 4 stages joke has made me laugh for decades. It's funny in the same way that getting attacked by a bear while standing in front of a caution bears sign is funny. It's a warning that prepares you for tragedy while doing nothing to prevent it. Stage 1, who is Nell Scovell, is a question I've pondered more than anyone on the planet. For those who have never given it a moment's thought, let me fill in the broad strokes. Nell Scovell is a TV writer, producer, and director who has worked on popular series like The Simpsons, NCIS, and Late Night with David Letterman, as well as cult favorites like Charmed, The Critic, and Mystery Science Theater 3000. We all know Sabrina is the first name of the teenage witch who fronted the hit ABC series in the 90s, but you might not know that Sabrina's last name was Spellman, because Irving Spellman was one of my dad's closest friends, and I chose that witchy surname when I created the series. Looking back on my career, I feel lucky and grateful, and all the other things women are supposed to feel so that people will like us. But I genuinely do feel lucky and grateful, because the average TV writer's career lasts about 11 years, and I managed to beat the odds. My first TV job could easily have been my last. I was 26 when I flew from New York to L.A. to meet with an executive producer about writing on a late-night comedy show for the brand-new Fox network. During my flight, I came up with pages of ideas and jokes for the meeting. I shouldn't have bothered. The executive producer talked nonstop, laying out his plans to combine comedy and journalism that would shake up the late-night format. After half an hour, he wrapped up his monologue and asked me a question. So, are you okay with moving to Los Angeles? Yes, I said, and since I finally had an opening, I continued. I jotted down some ideas if you want. He didn't want. Great, he said, jumping up from his chair. He told me his next call would be to my agent and that he was looking forward to working together. I practically skipped across the parking lot to my rental car. I had gotten the job and learned my first lesson about Hollywood meetings. The more you let people talk about themselves, the more they will like you. The show hired 10 writers, 9 men, and me. The team in the office next to mine was hilarious, and I couldn't wait to get to work every day and spend time with them. The 3 of us ate meals together, wrote sketches together, and after work, we'd play Pictionary and miniature ping pong. It was only their second TV job, and we all cared deeply about making the show a success. We figured if it flopped, our careers would be over. You've probably never heard of the Wilton North Report, but those writers, Conan O'Brien and Greg Daniels, did just fine. Greg went on to co-create King of the Hill, NBC's The Office, and Parks and Recreation. Conan went on to become Conan. Actually, Conan was always Conan. It's just that his audience expanded beyond our office hallway. Historically, talk shows are developed around a charismatic host. Not the Wilton North Report. 2 weeks before we launched, the executive producer still hadn't filled the position. Ellen DeGeneres auditioned and came across as both friendly and edgy, the ideal talk show host. The executive producer passed on her. In a panic, he dispatched Conan, Greg, and me to scout talent at a comedy club. The 3 of us struck up a conversation with Jay Leno, who happened to be hanging out in the lobby. Jay was already a household name as guest host of The Tonight Show. It would be another 2 years before NBC handed him the reins, and another 17 years before Jay handed them to Conan, and then another 9 months before Jay snatched them back. But that night, Jay was the coolest person in the world for chatting with 3 nerdy 20-somethings. At one point, I made a smart-ass comment, and Jay pointed at me. "You're funny," Jay declared. "You should do stand-up." "What, me? No," I said. "Why not?" "Because I'm a writer, not a performer." "Oh, come on," Jay coaxed, gesturing toward the showroom. "Don't you look at the people up there and think, hey, I could do better than that." "No. I look at those people, even the bad ones, and think, wow, they're really brave." Jay stared at me and then with perfect timing said, "You shouldn't do stand-up." The last thing I wanted was to attract attention. Gloria Steinem once said, "For me, writing was a way of staying invisible because I felt invisible, only a little seen through words." I agree with one adjustment. I didn't feel invisible, but I did feel like I was getting away with something, and if I just kept my head down, they'd let me keep doing it. Keeping a low profile also suited my New England upbringing, where you're only supposed to be in the papers 3 times: when you're born, when you marry, and when you murder your husband. Or something like that. My plan was sly: stay out of the spotlight, but near the action. It worked. I've stood on the red carpet at the Academy Awards as Daniel Craig passed by inches from me. I may have even touched the back of his tuxedo jacket, unless you think that's creepy, in which case I definitely did not. I've sat in a hotel suite late at night with Mark Zuckerberg and Andy Samberg working on a funny opening for a Facebook conference. And I've played Fuck, Marry, Kill with Key and Peele during an interview for Vanity Fair before the 2015 Emmys. My career has let me put words in the mouths of iconic performers like Bette Midler, Bob Newhart, Craig T. Nelson, and Miss Piggy. Those performers make everything funnier. It's like having Serena Williams as your doubles partner. If you can just get your serve in, she'll do all the work for the win. And just because you're invisible doesn't mean you're powerless. For 5 years, I contributed jokes to the White House Correspondents' Dinner, including one in 2012, where the punchline was the stage direction, wink. That night, I was responsible for making the leader of the free world shut his right eye. For a nanosecond, I was the most powerful person on the planet. Clearly, that power went to my head, because now I'm tossing off my cloak of invisibility. After a career capturing other voices, it's time to dig deeper into the question, who is Nell Scovell? I can already hear the conversation with a network executive. "Does it have to be Nell? What if you turned Nell into Neil?" "Why would I do that? You want men to read your book, right?
Right.
Then you gotta have a male main character. Helps them relate. Oh, and maybe Neil should be into Thai boxing. That's big these days. Think about it.
Okay, I did. And although Neil sounds awesome, his story just isn't that unusual. There are probably a dozen Thai boxing Neils who have written for TV, but when I started, it was hard to find any woman doing what I wanted to do. That's why in 1988, I was so excited when a manager connected me with Marilyn Suzanne Miller, one of the three original female writers on Saturday Night Live. Marilyn agreed to meet me for coffee near Gramercy Park, and I was eager to soak up her wisdom. She kept her sunglasses on throughout our coffee date, and while I don't recall the exact words, her advice basically boiled down to this. TV is a horrible business. You'd be lucky if it doesn't destroy you. Run. Run for your life. I left the coffee shop, rattled. I remember thinking that if I were ever in the position to speak with younger writers, I would not be so discouraging. Besides, my experience would be different from hers. Marilyn had to break the glass ceiling. Now, in part thanks to her, we were a decade closer to equality. If there were obstacles in my way, I would clear them. If there were people in my way, I would prove them wrong. I would rise up fighting. 30 years later, I want to thank Marilyn for trying to warn me. She was right. I quickly discovered that in Hollywood, the glass ceiling is not actually made of glass. Instead, it's made of that Terminator metal that shatters, then reconstitutes and reforms. I even thought about calling this book Just the Angry and Bitter Parts. But I want to keep my promise not to be discouraging. Also, that would be an 8-volume set. Television can be a horrible business, but my advice is not to run. There have been times that I wanted to bolt, like during the final week of directing my second film. We were on location at a women's club in Vancouver shooting a low-budget cable movie that I'd co-written with my sister Claire. After a strong morning, we came back from lunch, and the set fell apart. 3 hours later, we were 2.5 hours behind. During a scheduled break, I found a coat closet to hide in and sobbed. I called my friend Jesse Dillon and through gulps explained that it felt like the director of photography was sabotaging me and I didn't know what to do. Jesse is an experienced director, so I expected him to give me some practical advice. Line the actors up in a row. Go tight on their faces. Instead, he uttered three words that changed everything. Go down fighting. It was exactly what I needed to hear. I picked myself off the floor and headed back to the set to do the best I could with the situation I had. I think about Jesse's advice often. In Hollywood, you rise up fighting or you go down fighting. Either way, you're fighting. Now back to the funny parts. Stage 1. Who is Nell Scovell? Chapter 1. Every character needs a backstory. Question. What was the smartest dinosaur? Answer. Roget Thesaurus. The first joke I recall writing, circa 5th grade. I was born at Boston Lying-In Hospital on Tuesday, November 8th, 1960. On Wednesday, the entire state of Massachusetts celebrated. Those two events were not connected. On my birthday, Boston-bred John F. Kennedy defeated sweaty Richard M. Nixon at the voting booths. Kennedy became the youngest president ever elected, and that day marked a cultural shift that led to the youth movement, the civil rights movement, the feminist revolution, the sexual revolution, and the rise of pop culture. But I'm sure you have a cool birthday, too. 3 out of my 4 grandparents immigrated to the United States in the early 1900s. My paternal grandfather, Louis Scovell, fled Smorgon, Belarus, as a teenager and came in through Ellis Island. Louis used to tell stories about his teenage years in the old country, and having to bring the cows back to the barn while German bullets whizzed by his head. I will tell my own grandchildren about being forced to play dodgeball in middle school while wearing a horizontal striped spandex uniform. I've suffered too. Louis had minimal education but plenty of smarts. He married Rhoda Arntlicker of the Tarnopol Arntlickers, who came to America at the age of 4. Over the centuries, Tarnopol flipped between Poland and Austria, and since Rhoda was drawn to books and music, she preferred to self-identify as Austrian. My father, Mel, used to joke that each year his mother's birthplace moved closer to Vienna until eventually it was within the city limits. Rhoda kept a kosher home, but Louis loved bacon so much, he convinced a doctor to write a note saying bacon was necessary for his health. Told you he had smarts. My maternal grandfather, Reuben Cohn, was born in London, which sounds posh until you learn that his Polish mother gave birth while waiting to board a ship to New York. Buddy, as we called him, grew up in Greenwich Village and took any available job, rolling cigars, selling shoes. Eventually, he became a hat manufacturer. Buddy's wife, Frances Cohen, was born in Brooklyn, although she never knew the exact date, so we celebrated her birthday on Thanksgiving. Her parents put her to work as a child, sewing appliques on dresses, which makes her one of Brooklyn's original artisanal lifestyle enhancers. Frances loved science and dreamed of studying medicine. The closest she could get was to become a podiatrist who filed calluses and treated ingrown toenails on Park Avenue. Louis went into the retail shoe business, and he and Rhoda settled in the working-class town of Brockton, Massachusetts, where my father was born and raised. Brockton produced two world-class boxers, Rocky Marciano and Marvelous Marvin Hagler, proving that people would rather get punched in the face than stay in Brockton. My mother, Cynthia, nicknamed Sookie, was born in the equally badass factory town of Fall River, Massachusetts. Like many first-generation Americans, my parents discovered that the key to upward mobility was, 1, not living in Europe during Hitler's reign, and 2, focusing on education. By 1951, Mel had graduated from Yale and was stationed at Fort Eustis near the College of William and Mary, where Sookie was majoring in math. Mel says they were introduced because they were the only two Jews in Virginia. Sookie fell in love with Mel because he made her laugh. Sookie made Mel feel loved. Less than a year later, they married and moved to the Boston area. In 8 years, they made 5 kids. Julie, Alice, me, Ted, and Claire. You may have noticed that I'm right in the middle. Yeah, I noticed that too. The 5 of us were tight-knit, bookish, and only slightly less neurotic than J.D. Salinger's Glass family. We loved one another, and the way we expressed this was by constant and merciless teasing. We made fun of one sister for having a small head. She doesn't. And another for having allergies. I do. Leave me alone. We made up songs like the I'm Always Right song, which was sung to the tune of Chopin's Grande Valse Brillante, and featured lyrics that looped, I'm always right, you're always wrong. While building snow forts in the backyard, my brother Ted enjoyed blocking the path of his sisters who desperately needed to go inside and pee. Then he'd make us laugh until it was too late. We were relentlessly cruel and yet completely devoted to one another. This was the best possible training for a career in a TV writer's room. My parents provided us with a comfortable and stable childhood. We moved once, a full 5 miles from Belmont to Newton. Sometimes I feel like my uneventful upbringing puts me at a disadvantage in my chosen profession. I'm a little jealous of writers who come from southern Gothic families filled with alcoholics and vampires. The first time I met comedy legend Meryl Marco, she asked me to contribute to a side project where she compiled stories from women with narcissistic mothers. Why do you think I have something to offer? I asked. Well, you're funny, Meryl said, and a lot of my funny female friends had mothers who just focused on themselves. I'm sorry to disappoint you, I said, but I had the warmest, nicest mom. Sookie was cheerful and helpful and my staunchest defender.
At my third-grade parent-teacher conference, the teacher complained that I made too many jokes during class. She asked my mother to talk to me about toning it down. My mother said she'd pass the message along, and she did, on my 40th birthday. My mother waited 32 years until I was an established comedy writer to tell me that my third-grade teacher had notes on my personality. Sookie found a way to protect without smothering. Her unconditional love is one of the reasons that I could withstand so much criticism and rejection over the years. It's my Harry Potter scar. Sookie died in 2004 at 72 from pancreatic cancer. At her funeral, I spoke about how I never saw my mother embarrassed. That's because to feel embarrassed, you have to want to be seen in a particular light and then fail. My mom never pretended to be something she wasn't. There was nothing phony about her. Basically, she was the antithesis of Hollywood. While my mom offered support, my dad offered challenge. Mel liked it when his kids got good grades. And when we didn't, we were all too scared to find out. His philosophy on life was clear. Be logical, be ethical, be honest. No lies were tolerated in my family, not even white lies. Here's an actual conversation I had with my dad after emailing him a caricature of me that appeared in Vanity Fair. Me. Hey, did you get the caricature I sent you? Dad. Yes, I saw it. It's not flattering, but it looks like you. Complete honesty is a truly admirable way to raise your children until one decides to go work in the TV and movie business. Then she will feel blindsided. The constant barrage of lies in the entertainment industry confused and dismayed me, especially in the beginning. Eventually, I cracked the code. If something seems like good news, it's probably a lie. 8 lies writers hear all the time. 1. I'll read your script this weekend. 2. This is brilliant. We just have a couple of notes. 3. If we hire anyone, it'll be you. 4. Hey, your show, your vision. 5. We can't pay you, but it's good exposure. 6. Nothing is happening in town right now. 7. We're looking for someone who can think outside the box. 8. We want the lead to be a strong woman. My tendency to tell the truth has definitely hurt my career. In the early 90s, I had a meeting with a producer who had the rights to make a movie version of an old TV series. The producer mentioned that he wanted Jim Belushi for the lead. My lousy poker face gave me away. What, don't you like him? The producer asked. Not really, I said bluntly. I just never thought he had half the talent of his brother. The producer opened his arms in disbelief. Look who's shitting on Jim Belushi! I didn't get that job, but my dad would have been proud of me. As a kid, I often sat on the arm of Mel's reclining chair and helped him solve British crossword puzzles, deciphering anagrams and puns. My dad loved wordplay. Driving along the highway in the early 70s, Mel suddenly called to the back seat. Kids, who does Sonny love and how much? We had no idea what he was talking about. Then he pointed at a hotel sign in the distance. Sheraton. Share. A ton. My dad also passed along his love of science fiction to me. During the summers, my sisters devoured Charlotte Bronte and Jane Austen, while I sat in a turquoise butterfly chair reading Ray Bradbury and Philip K. Dick. In college, I took an independent study in fantasy novels with Thomas Shippey, a visiting professor from the UK who was dubbed Tolkien's last protege. Professor Shippey was actually friends with Harry Harrison, who wrote Make Room, Make Room, the novella that became the movie Soylent Green. I thought that was the coolest thing. What was less cool was when Professor Shippey mentioned that he wrote fiction under a pseudonym. What name? I said. I want to read it. I can't tell you, he said. Why not? Because the books are rather misogynistic, he answered. My love for science fiction extended to TV shows, including the original Star Trek and The Twilight Zone, which both ran in syndication during my high school years.
I also memorized the prisoner's defiant number 6 declaration. I will not be pushed, filed, stamped, indexed, briefed, debriefed, or numbered. My life is my own. That made my little teenage heart beat faster. Actually, it makes my 50-something heart beat faster, too. On the weekends, my siblings and I watched black-and-white screwball comedies from the 1930s and 1940s. The Thin Man series and the Marx Brothers delighted us. Groucho, Harpo, and Chico were agents of chaos, apt to break into song, and siblings who got on each other's nerves. No wonder we loved them. We were also lucky to come of age when Woody Allen was dating Diane Keaton and not a family member. Mel took us to the theater to see Sleeper and my favorite, Love and Death. Still, for sheer giddiness, you couldn't beat Young Frankenstein. Gene Wilder's gentle oddness complemented Mel Brooks's irreverent broadness. Young Frankenstein also featured Terry Garr and Madeline Kahn, who were adorable and hysterical. Years later, I got to hang out with Terry and watched as some friends offered her a joint. "No thanks," she said. "I get high on life." Most Hollywood memoirs dish about celebs doing drugs. I'm going in a different direction. In my early teens, two new sketch comedy shows started airing on TV, and I knew they were special because my parents thought they were weird. Monty Python's Flying Circus smashed highbrow into lowbrow, and I memorized sketches about drunken philosophers, ex-parrots, and arguments about arguments. Only a handful of friends got the humor, and it bonded us. At school, we'd greet each other. "Hello, Mrs. Premise. Hello, Mrs. Conclusion." Saturday Night Live was far more popular, premiering in October of my high school freshman year. In the days before YouTube, if you wanted to understand why kids were talking about land sharks on Monday, you had to keep your sleepy ass up late on Saturday. The sensibility of Monty Python appealed to me more, but SNL had something that British Troupe didn't have. Funny women. The first SNL cast featured 3 women and 4 men, groundbreaking for its time. I admired Gilda Radner, the original manic pixie dream girl, but I adored the tougher, more straight-laced Jane Curtin. She held her own against Dan Aykroyd, and even as a conehead, Curtin came across as strangely real. Closer to home, my aunts Jane and Pinky, Mel's sisters, would regularly crack up any room they were in. Aunt Jane liked opera, ballet, and fart jokes, and she wasn't afraid to work blue, as the Borscht Belt comics would say. At a family gathering, she once sidled over to me. "Hey, I've got one for you," she said. "Mabel and Molly are rocking on the porch of a retirement home." Jane switched to a wistful old lady voice. "Mabel, do you remember the minuet?" Then in a coarser voice, "Molly, I don't even remember the men I fucked." It took me 15 years to get that joke. Aunt Pinky's humor was darker. Once, my sister Alice was sprawled on the couch reading Little Women, when Pinky walked by, tapped her on the shoulder, and said, "Don't get too attached to Beth." Jane and Pinky were early role models and a reason why I've always known that women are as funny as men. Throughout my childhood, I never saw any evidence to the contrary. Who's funnier than Gene Hagen in Singin' in the Rain? Or droller than Myrna Loy lining up martinis in The Thin Man? I cheered when Johnny Carson went on vacation and Joan Rivers guest-hosted The Tonight Show. And sure, Bob Newhart was the star of The Bob Newhart Show, but co-stars Suzanne Pleshette and Marsha Wallace topped him all the time. The ability to make people laugh is not tied to any physical characteristic, including skin color, hair color, nose size, penis size, or lack thereof. People of every religion can be funny, especially when they're making fun of their own religion. Gay people do seem to be a little funnier than straight people, but maybe straight people go into closets and tell jokes. For me, Kurt Vonnegut settled the matter in 7 words. Some people are funny. Some are not. I was fortunate to be surrounded by funny people from birth. Still, wisecracking was viewed as a hobby, not a profession.
My dad is hilarious, and ran not-for-profit healthcare centers in low-income communities. Aunt Pinky was the most sarcastic person I knew, and conducted research at Columbia University. My own career path pointed in two directions, doctor or lawyer. Since my grandmother wanted to study medicine but couldn't pursue that dream, I went to college planning to achieve it for her. A teaching assistant in my intro biology class said, "No, you won't." A C-plus in the easiest science class freshman year destroyed any hope of becoming a surgeon. Now I always advise high school students, don't follow your dreams, follow your talents. Writing came far more easily to me than science. I turned to that instead. Although I still play surgeon once a year, every Thanksgiving I insist on carving the turkey. Haven't saved a patient yet. Chapter 2. Sports and Spy. Writing is the hardest thing to do and the easiest thing to piss on. Irving Brecker, Oscar-nominated screenwriter. At every panel about TV writing that I've sat on, an audience member will invariably ask, "How did you break in?" Invariably, I will answer, "That's a terrible question." This usually gets an uncomfortable laugh because no one's expecting the nice panel lady to be so rude. I answer bluntly to make an impression, then I explain that if you ask 1,000 different writers, "How did you break in?" you'll get 1,000 different answers. But if you ask 1,000 different writers, "Why did you break in?" you'll get the same answer. We wrote. A writer's career begins long before securing that first job or agent. Arranging words in entertaining ways can take many forms. Essays, plays, stand-up, sketches, poetry, magazine articles, songs, and tweets. There's an old saying that a writer writes, but that's just the start. A writer writes a lot, and then shares that work with others. My friend Amy Hone described the process perfectly. One day, during a long walk through Central Park, she said, "The only way to move forward creatively is to allow yourself to be judged." I stopped in my tracks and dug out a pen so I could jot down her observation. I've even thought about having it tattooed on my body, maybe in Chinese characters if that's shorter. Writing is not what you start. It's not even what you finish. It's what you start, finish, and put out there for the world to see. Sometimes we're afraid to share our work because we know those twin jerks, criticism and rejection, are out there waiting to beat us up. Once the assault begins, there are three possible responses. One, run away from the jerks. Two, defend yourself against the jerks. Three, assume the position and say, "Thank you, sir, may I have another?" The third choice hurts like hell, but the jerks often have useful feedback. Some writers fear the blank page. To me, that's like fearing an empty dog dish. The page is just something you fill every day. Other writers insist, "I hate writing, but I love having written." I'm the freak who enjoys the process of writing, especially those moments when I fall into a flow and become totally absorbed by a project. As a middle child, it was hard getting my voice heard, so being able to express myself without interruption feels like a luxury. John Irving observed, "Before you can write anything, you have to notice something." This may explain why I initially gravitated to journalism. Reporting is all about noticing. In high school, I became news editor of Denebola, the oddly named Newton South High School newspaper. When I got to college, I was eager to continue down the path of serious news journalism. The second week of my freshman year, I entered the stone and brick building of the Harvard Crimson, where a group had gathered to comp, that is, compete, to join the paper's staff. Editors addressed the group, making pitches for their various departments, news, opinion, the arts magazine. A senior wearing a rumpled overcoat and holding a cigar took the floor. He looked like he was auditioning for the part of Oscar Madison in a Sarasota dinner theater production of The Odd Couple. It was a short audition. He uttered just two sentences. "Anyone who's cool, stick around. We're going to talk about writing sports." An air horn went off in my head. I'd never been cool in my life, and someone had just offered me an opportunity to change that. Sports writing wouldn't be a stretch for me either. I'd been manager of the boys' track team in high school, and my brother was a ranked New England tennis player. Being a Boston sports fan was easy in the late 60s and 70s. The Bruins were world champions. The Celtics were world champions. The Red Sox were almost world champions. The Boston Patriots were not the champions that the New England Patriots are today, but I liked the young quarterback Jim Plunkett. I took dinner theater Oscar Madison up on his offer. I stuck around and became a sports writer. I'm still waiting to be cool. The decision was made impulsively and remains one of the best of my life. Covering straight news didn't quite suit me. I always felt like I was playing at being serious. My brainy crimson colleagues like Nicholas Kristof, Susan Chira, and David Sanger were reporting on apartheid protests while I spent fall weekends on the banks of the Charles River covering crew skulls gliding through perfectly arched bridges as the sun burnished the red and gold leaves. Who's the brainy one now? Sports editor John Donnelly taught me that a game's final score was the news hook, but the real story concerned the characters on the field and the history between the teams. Competition is deeply emotional. It's not just who wins and loses. It's the thrill of victory and the agony of defeat. For one of my first college assignments, I interviewed actor Tommy Lee Jones, who played offensive guard on the legendary Harvard 1968 football team, which staged a 16-point comeback in the final 43 seconds against Yale. The Crimson headline the next day blared, "Harvard beats Yale 29-29. On the 10th anniversary of The Game, I spoke to Jones about its significance. "Ending my career with that particular game against Yale was like dying and going to heaven," he told me. That's fugitive-level drama. Fledgling sports writers were taught to sweat over the first paragraph, the lead, where the goal is to inform and amuse. Once, when covering a regional track and field event, the men's team tied for second place after a day of competition, and the perfect lead popped into my head. Back in the Crimson building, I smiled as I banged out my killer opening, which played off an old saying. I wrote, "If a tie for first is like kissing your sister, then a tie for second is like French kissing her." I finished my story and handed it to the copy editor. He read the lead, then looked up at me. "Is this a joke?" I nodded. "Funny, right?" "No, it's in really bad taste." I watched him slash a line through my lead. "What are you doing?" I cried. "We can't print this," he said. The editor and I argued over what was appropriate. I lost. The fact that I couldn't see his point about the line's tastelessness was an early sign that I might be more suited to comedy than journalism. I truly believe that if you're a comedy writer and have never been told you've gone too far, then you haven't gone far enough. I also believe that if you're constantly told you've gone too far, then maybe you're an asshole. My colleagues in the sports cube, as our tiny office was called, were fun and supportive. I moved up the ladder and sophomore year became one of three associate sports editors who reported to newly crowned sports editor Jeffrey Toobin. Jeff is now a CNN legal analyst, best-selling author, and one of the most entertaining people on the planet. He still loves sports. In 2008, Jeff was providing commentary during a vice presidential debate and got busted when eagle-eyed viewers spotted him watching a National League playoff game on his laptop. Come on. It was a vice presidential debate. Junior year, I toyed with the idea of comedy writing and attended an introductory meeting at the Harvard Lampoon. The humor magazine's premises were dark and a little smelly, even to a college student. The Lampoon editor running the comp meeting was intimidatingly tall and had an enormous head. His instructions seemed designed to scare us off. Compers would be required to turn in 3 pieces, which would be thrown on the floor. Lampoon editors would then read and write comments on the back, where the criticisms could be viewed by everyone. The potential for public humiliation seemed high, but did I let this guy stop me from pursuing my dreams? Yes. Yes, I did. I never went back to the Lampoon. Over a decade later, I was chatting with then-Simpsons writer Jeff Martin, and we discovered that we'd been in the same college class and hadn't known each other. "You should have comped for the Lampoon," he said enthusiastically. "We would have loved you." I was touched, then noticed he was intimidatingly tall and had an enormous head. He'd been the comp director who had scared me off. Now he wasn't scary at all. I'd been foolish back in college not to even try. I refused to allow myself to be judged, and I didn't move forward creatively. Heading into senior year, my plan was to throw myself into writing a thesis on the influence of Ecclesiastes on early 20th century American literature. Fortunately, an August phone call changed that plan. Out of the blue, a Boston Globe sports editor tracked me down while I was still at home in Newton. He'd read some of my Crimson articles and was wondering if I'd be interested in joining a team of 4 college students covering high school sports for the city newspaper. It was like getting called up to the big leagues. I ditched Ecclesiastes and went pro. The other 3 schoolboy correspondents were enrolled at Northeastern University. I later learned a 4th NU student had been selected, a female, but she fell out at the last minute. When that first choice fell through, it would have been easy for the editors to say, "Well, we tried for diversity," and then hire another male. They didn't. And whenever I hear a TV producer say, "We'd love to have more female writers, but we just can't find any," my response is, "You're not looking hard enough." Vince Doria, who led the Globe's award-winning sports coverage in the 80s, did more than just make an effort. He made a difference. On a typical week at the Globe, I might write a field hockey roundup and profile a cross-country runner. Each Saturday, I'd cover a high school football game in some remote Massachusetts town. I'd spend the week taking a crash course in the town's football history, then freeze my ass off watching the game while my roommates were back in our dorm room sleeping off their Friday night fun. The deadlines were brutal. On the drive back to the newsroom, I'd start composing the copy in my head. I once screeched into the Globe parking lot, threw my blue Ford into park, jumped out, and slammed the locked door just as I noticed my keys dangling from the ignition. I stared in horror for a beat, then realized I had no time to consider what an idiot I was. I sprinted toward the building to file my story. Working at the Globe taught me how to swear, guzzle lousy coffee, and find towns in Massachusetts that are still not on Google Maps. It was a treat to sit desks away from world-class sports writers Will McDonough, Leslie Visser, and Lee Montville. Most of the full-time Globe reporters ignored the college correspondents, but veteran Mike Madden used to stop by my desk to offer encouragement. One day, he threw me a great piece of advice about journalism. "Specialize," he told me. "There will always be better writers out there, but if you're the expert on a subject and that subject comes up, they'll call you." About a week later, he stopped by my desk again. "I was just thinking, I've never seen a woman in the press box at boxing matches." He handed me a flyer for a local boxing event. "That would be a good specialty. You should go," he said. I sensed that he was right, but I wasn't cut out for boxing. In all my favorite sports, an athlete got a penalty for throwing a punch. I tossed the flyer away and then watched as boxing exploded in the second half of the 80s. If I'd taken Mike's advice and started doing my homework in 1981, I would have been positioned perfectly. There was another hitch. Sports writing in general had begun to lose its appeal to me. My direct editor at the Globe was a just-the-facts-ma'am kind of guy who wasn't looking for a clever lead. After I graduated from college, I hoped to find an editor that appreciated humor. I moved to New York and took a day job as an executive assistant answering phones for a CEO on the Forbes 500. I took any writing job that came my way, including my first paid magazine assignment from Cosmopolitan. Helen Gurley Brown was still at the helm, and the editor commissioned me to write an essay, My Three Ghastly Weeks with a Grade C Lover. I saved almost all my early writing, but somehow this piece has been lost to time. Not an accident. My writing career was slow to take off because I acquired an unfortunate habit in my early 20s. Some spend their post-college years in a haze of pot smoke. I liked to get married. I did it twice, and got divorced twice, all before the age of 26. I guess you could call me a romantic. Seriously, only a true romantic would throw herself into a second marriage just 6 months after the first one failed. My first husband was my college sweetheart and a second-year student at NYU Law School. He was brilliant and kind and knew exactly what he wanted to do with his life. I was 22 and floundering. When he was selected for a prestigious clerkship, I left my job as an executive assistant and moved to the District of Columbia several months ahead of him. I'd taken a low-paying job answering constituent mail for a Massachusetts congressman. The work was serious, and I was unhappy. Our marriage collapsed. By the time he got to D.C., I was on my way back to New York. Feeling wobbly about my life, I started dating the son of the CEO I'd been working for. We'd hung out a lot at the office and got along great. He was 7 years older and really wanted to get married. In my eagerness to cover up my first marital misstep, I made an even bigger one. The second marriage was troubled from the start. We exchanged vows at my family home in Newton and then flew to Nantucket for a short weekend honeymoon with a longer trip to China planned for the fall. I woke up the next morning in a quaint B&B to the sound of my brand new husband pacing. Okay, it was more like stomping. "Is something wrong?" I asked. "I've got to get off this island," he said, agitated. "I'm suffocating." Metaphor much? We left Nantucket and drove around New England for 2 days with no destination. It was madness. The Adventures of Buckaroo Banzai Across the Eighth Dimension had come out a couple of years earlier, and my brain played a loop of Buckaroo's pronouncement, "No matter where you go, there you are." Our lives should have been happy, living in a lovely apartment overlooking the Central Park Reservoir. Yet we argued over everything, even over where to eat dinner. "If I want Italian and you want Japanese, why can't you compromise and have Italian?" my husband once said to me, redefining the word compromise. We never made it to China. I hung in for over a year and then pulled the plug. He did not object. After two divorces, I felt utterly humiliated. Fortunately, I had a supportive family. My father tried to make me feel better. "Look, you didn't have kids," he told me. "So the way I see it is, you had two very serious boyfriends." I would never recommend anyone follow my lead, but the failed marriages did help me in a few ways. Like many young women, I entered the workforce assuming someday I'd get married, have kids, and then leave my job to raise them. After two divorces, I scratched getting married as a life goal. Been there, done that, done that. I became determined to never again let a relationship derail my work. Writing became my salvation, a professional way to prove my value after those personal failures. My divorces also taught me not to get trapped in a bad decision. I keep two pillows in my office emblazoned with my favorite sports quotes. One pillow says, "Never change a winning game." The other says, "Always change a losing game." I know it's not always possible to walk away from a losing game. Some tough situations must be endured. But if change becomes an option, I'll grab it. In the summer of 1986,
I was still looking for a non-humiliating way out of my second marriage.
Plane crash?
When a new magazine called Spy approached my then-husband looking for investors. He wasn't interested, but tossed me the prospectus and said, "This sounds like something you'd like." Let the record show, my ex was right about one thing. Spy billed itself as a satirical monthly with the tagline, "Smart, funny, fearless." The magazine's mission was to eschew fawning profiles and call out the hypocrisy of the rich and powerful. This irreverent attitude is common now, it's called the internet. But you can arguably trace the origin of the snark ages back to Spy. I contacted magazine co-founders Kurt Anderson and Graydon Carter, and they invited me down to their unfurnished raw office space in the Puck building. Seated on folding chairs, I pitched 10 story ideas. They hired me as Spy's first reporter. Sheryl Sandberg likes to quote the advice, "If you're offered a seat on a rocket ship, don't ask what seat. Just get on." Spy was a rocket ship and changed the trajectory of my life. Going to the office was a welcome distraction. People were funny but gruff. There was a lot of teasing and shouting over partitions. In short, it felt like home. Given my recent experience, it's not a coincidence that my beat for the magazine became spotlighting the foibles of New York's wealthy. I started with creatures so entitled that they had an extra set of legs. The article, "How Rich Is That Doggy in the Limo?" gently mocked A-list dog owners and included ingenious photos of pampered pets shot in softcore porn lighting. My reporting started at the townhouse of Pat Buckley, wife of William F., who bragged about how her King Charles Spaniels were related to President Ronald Reagan's dogs, that is, the first pets. Another pet owner said she kept her miniature poodle on a strict diet because Air France had an 11-pound limit for pets traveling in Le Club class. A Park Avenue veterinarian told me that he was performing a lot more cosmetic surgery, including wart removal and eye lifts for Sharpays. "How Rich Is That Doggy in the Limo?" was supposed to skewer these over-the-top pet owners. Instead, the piece was received warmly. It was the mid-80s, and excess was in. Regis Philbin even booked me on his cable access